Okay, good morning, everyone. Oh, sorry. Okay, good morning, everyone. Welcome. It's been a long time. Welcome to... yes, too long, right. It's been particularly long this year because I was away towards the end of the term in New York. And anyway, but welcome back to Bina 2024, term one. It's going to be an exciting term. Lots of new stuff happening. Please keep looking at all the WhatsApps and emails. It's going to be nighttime home shiurim, as we've been doing the last couple of years, happening once in a while. And of course, in 2 weeks' time from tonight, on the 15th of February, the Bina 25 celebration, 25 years of Bina, which is great. thank you to all of you who have booked already. For those who haven't booked yet, please do. There's a link going around. By the way, for those who have booked, because I heard this other day, you will be getting, sometimes you get messages from me and it looks like a private message. It's actually a broadcast, for those that know the WhatsApp terminology, which means a lot of people are getting it. So don't get upset if I ask you please to book and you've booked, and I've been asking now 3 times and you booked already 2 weeks ago. It's just a message that's going around. So if you've booked, ignore it. Don't ignore anything else, but you can ignore those messages if you've booked already. If you haven't booked, don't ignore it. But we'll talk about that later. Okay. It's going to be really an exciting event, a meaningful event, celebration, meaning it'll be a whole musical with a... I'm not going to give too much away, but it's going to be very beautiful. Okay. So this is a longer term, actually. So this particular series that we're starting today is going to be for from now, from today, till the 7th of March, and then we're going to change topics. But we'll go through the term, please God. So a little background. A few months ago, I was listening to a podcast from overseas, and the host of the podcast was interviewing a guy called David Rosmarin, who was about to publish a book. It wasn't even out yet at the time. I think it's the first time I've ordered a book before it's come out. Was about to put up a book, who had developed a different approach in treating anxiety and a different perspective, and it all sounded very interesting. And of course, the first thought that came to my mind was Thursday morning. Which, by the way, is not such a good thing, because it reminded me of an old saying they used to say back in the shtetl. There was a saying which I heard from, you know, people of yesteryear. They used to say that magidim tu nishkin shuvah. What that means is that preachers, they used to have in the little shtetl, used to go around from shtetl to shtetl. They would come and inspire people, and sometimes admonish people, and sometimes push people, and to return, to reconnect, to improve, and so on. And they used to say that these magidim, these preachers, they never do it themselves. Why not? Because they used to say that whenever they would hear something inspiring, instead of internalizing it and taking it to themselves and seeing how they can be affected by it, their first thought is, which drasha can I hear that from? Can I use that for? You know what I'm saying? They used to say like, oh, where can I use that? So I'm guilty of that sometimes, but then I try not to do that. But it reminds me of my mother, blessed memory, she would come here and she would seem a little bit stressed or moving too quickly and not being present enough. She would say, do you practice what you preach? She was a big fan of the Thursday morning, so she would say, do you practice what you preach? She was the only one who could tell me straight like that, you know. Anyway, but having said that, the book is aimed at a simple idea. And the simple idea is, it's this book, by the way, in case anyone wants to. It's called Thriving with Anxiety by David Rosmarin. And it's aimed at a simple idea that most people, of course, are very scared of anxiety. Now, anxiety comes in different forms, different levels, and we all have a bit of it from time to time. And people are generally very scared to be anxious, and they're obsessed with getting rid of it. Right? And often what happens is, he explains that the fear of having anxiety brings more anxiety. Right? And often what people do is they jump right away to medication and to do whatever they can to sort of get rid of the anxiety. Now, his approach is, and we'll talk about it in a moment, but his approach is that we should be less scared of having anxiety and learn to live with it and actually channel it and push it out there to do some amazing things, right? So it sounded very interesting, and he was explaining this on the podcast. So I ordered the book, and it's an interesting read. And this series is based on that book. But before I get into it, I just want to clarify a couple of things. First of all, as we've said many, many times, there is never one approach to anything, right? That's a fallacy. Normally when people write books, it's written that way. This is the answer to life, right? But the reader of the book needs to always know that that's not true. It's an approach. It might work. It's good. It's got some good things. It might need to come in combination with other approaches. It might be good for a certain circumstance and scenario, but not good for others. It might not work for some and work for others. So just take it like that, right? Also, to point out that, like always, the series is not going to be completely based on the book, because there's some very interesting ideas here that branch into other things, which I'm going to address as well. Just general concepts as well. And then, of course, what I'm going to try and do is give you the Jewish perspective, and that, as always, will result in sometimes disagreeing with the author. So what I want to do today is look at the introduction of the book and how it all came about and the context. And in the introduction, he actually shares some foundational stuff that is good not just for anxiety, but good for lots of challenges that we have. So he begins, and it's an interesting story. He begins with his own story. It happened with his own background. He was a he had spent more than 10 years in studying and teaching at Harvard Medical School. And then he had a chance, an opportunity arose to start a anxiety clinic in New York. Right? I'm just giving you the story because it's relevant to the context. Now, he lived in Boston, of course, but it would require him to commute and spend 2 days a week in Manhattan. But it was a very good opportunity, he thought, and he decided to do it. However, soon after that, a problem arose that he didn't anticipate, and that was that he was very well known in Boston, but not at all well known in New York. So it actually wasn't taking off much. He barely got any referrals, which he thought would come quickly. And initially only had one patient who couldn't afford his prices. He had to give him a reduced rate. So the bills, he rented an office for a year and he furnished it and so on and so forth. He got a bit stressed, as people do when they get stressed. He started eating badly, so he would run for lunch to some really bad restaurants. I mean, the restaurants are probably good, but I mean bad food. Eating greasy food and all that kind of stuff. And his anxiety was really rising, and his mentors and his wife and his family said it was still early and he should stick with it and so on. But he was really anxious. And then he says the story one morning after he'd arrived from Boston to New York, he received the email that his one patient had to cancel. And he writes, he says, "A wave of anxiety swept over me. This was followed quickly by a sense of self-criticism for being hypercritical, followed by a surge of catastrophic thinking. Well, I thought, I'm supposed to be helping people overcome their anxiety, and I'm feeling anxious myself. How will I ever be successful? I must be headed for failure." Right? That was his thinking. And that's a typical sort of thinking pattern with people that have anxiety. So at that moment, he realized he needed to practice what he preached. And he says to himself, almost blurting it out in the middle of the street, "You decided to take a big challenge, and right now it's a genuinely stressful situation. In fact, if you weren't feeling anxious during a challenge, it's probably not a worthwhile in the first place. You're dreaming big, and it's inevitable that you're going to hit some thorny issues along the way. Be humble, accept the challenges head on. It's okay if it's not going your way. Just because you're not successful out of the gate doesn't mean you're not going to flourish down the road. Let go of your need for control and don't let your anxiety get in the way. You have a goal, you have a dream. This is something you want to do, and you don't need to let the anxiety stop you. You can transcend it. Your anxiety is normal. You know deep down that the limits are not real, only perceived, and you don't need to give up just because the going is tough." And that was his turning point for a whole new look at the concept of anxiety, right? So he says that what started out as a near panic attack had turned into a moment of internal connection. His self-talk had shifted from criticism and catastrophizing to acceptance and encouragement. So what he was really saying was that he learned to stop and say, "I can do this with the anxiety. And in fact, the anxiety is good, because what the anxiety is going to do, it's going to be like a wake-up call, and it's going to propel me into more determination, more resilience, and more effort. And it worked for him, and in fact, he based his whole clinic on that model, and the clinic actually became a very, very successful enterprise. Now, let's just clarify it. First of all, it doesn't mean that feeling anxious is a good thing, right? I guess the point of the whole book is it's not that being anxious is a good thing, because being anxious normally is not a good thing, but it's what we do with it is that counts, right? And it's okay. It's about using the discomfort of anxiety as a catalyst for greater things. I think that's the point of the book. Now, let's just develop this a little bit. Okay. This idea of you have something that is apparently negative or a challenge or can be debilitating, and then realizing that really depends what you do with it is actually a very, very old concept, and it's a foundational concept in many, many, many things. So I'm going to just share with you a couple of insights that came to mind as I was reading this. First is, there's a little book that I study every day. I'll give you the background. It's called Hayom Yom. Hayom Yom it was written in 1943. The background to the book was this. The previous Lubavitcher Rebbe asked his son-in-law, who later became the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the last Lubavitcher Rebbe, to print a calendar. Originally, it was actually going to be a yearly thing, but it only turned out 1 year. To print a calendar, and that every day there should be a quote, something like a, right? So what the Rebbe did was he printed this calendar, and what he did was he took the archives or the copies of all the letters that the previous Rebbe would send to people, and he pulled out beautiful quotes and relevant things and important ideas that he would put on each day. And it was a year-long thing. And since then, many, many, many Hasidic people study it every day. It takes a couple of minutes just to have a look at the quote for the day. So in this book, Hayom Yom, there is two quotes on different days about almost the same topic that seem to contradict each other. And I remember when I was young and studying it, I always wondered about it until I realized that it's not a contradiction at all. The one quote is that it talks about the concept of, in Hebrew it's called an anacha, which is a sigh. In Yiddish, like a kvetch. You know, people kvetch, you know, yeah. Right? You've been around people that kvetch a lot, it's like annoying, right? Okay. So, and it's a kvetch, what you do like when things aren't going well, and like, you know, you're complaining, and it's like that kind of thing, right? So the one quote says, Tov pu'ula achat mi elef anachot. One good action is better than 1,000 kvetches, right? Than 1,000 sighs. That's one. The second one, much later, in another month, says that a Jewish kvetch, as he says, and if someone sighs, if someone kvetches, even if it's coming from a physical problem, not even a spiritual problem, but he's kvetching because he's experiencing something challenging spiritually. One kvetch, he says there, is a very lofty and high level of tshuva, of like improvement and connection. And I think to myself, 1 second, we just said that 1,000 kvetches don't come to one good deed, right? And yet, there it says that one kvetch can be the expression of a very intense and high level of the concept of tshuva, which you normally talk about around Elul Rosh Hashanah time, but the idea of tshuva means improvement and growth and reconnection and return and so on and so forth. Right? So what does that mean? But the answer is very simple. The answer is, it's not the kvetch that's the problem. It's what you do with it and what it does to you and what you do with it. Right? There is a kvetch which paralyzes you. And then there's a kvetch and a discomfort which creates a sense of urgency. And they worlds apart. Right? When you kvetch as a paralysis, it's kvetching because you're scared of something, you're complaining about something, you actually don't know what to do about it, so you escape into the world of kvetching. You complain, you kvetch, you feel upset, you feel anxious, you feel uncomfortable. Right? That doesn't do anything. And then just go do something good. Just do one good thing, it'll be better than 1,000 kvetches, right? And then the second one, obviously, is something different. Second one is that when you feel upset, you feel anxious, you feel like you've given out a real good kvetch, what they say in Yiddish, a krechts, right? Then, but you do it you treat it as a call to action, a sense of urgency, and it's a whole different story. Then that is a great thing to happen to someone. When you're feeling uncomfortable and you say, well, I'm feeling uncomfortable, so what am I going to do about it? And how's it going to propel me into something much, much greater? That's unbelievable. So it's not a contradiction. It's the same kvetch, but a different one altogether. Which connects to another thing. I've heard this idea many times, but I just saw it in an article that someone was writing. Beautiful article, long article, written by Robertson in America somewhere, where she writes about two challenges that she had. One is more recent, thinking and being anxious and having tremendous anxiety because she has a son in the army in Israel and he was in Gaza and so on. And the other is a long-standing problem of a daughter that she has that has a real mental health crisis and has been going for years in and out of hospital. And she writes about her challenge, and she writes about her conversation with the God. It's a very, very beautiful article. And one of the things that she writes is a famous idea. I think Rabbi Sachs quotes it as well, if I'm not mistaken. That very, very often when something happens to us, something that's overwhelming, something that's anxiety-inducing, something that's really, really challenging, one of the conscious or subconscious thoughts that often comes into our mind is lama. Why? Why is this happening to me? So the word lama, right? The word lama in Hebrew is lamed mem hey. Lama, why? The word in Hebrew, lama, right? But in Hebrew, you know, words are often written without vowels, and therefore they can be reread differently. So the word lama can be read lama, why? Or lama, for what? For what? Same word. Lama is why, lama is for what. And the consequence of that is tremendous. Now, it is normal and natural for us to ask the question lama. That's the initial reaction. None of us want to be uncomfortable. None of us want to have anxiety. None of us want to have challenges, right? As we've said many times, we pray every day. That's part of our tefillah. Where we say, "Al tivi einu li dei nisayon, please God, do not test me." We don't want to be tested. But at the end of the day, we are tested sometimes, right? And our initial response is, like, what am I going to do with this? And that's normal. We shouldn't be, that's an important thing, by the way. When I say what we do is something, we shouldn't feel guilty about not doing the proper thing with it as we should do. Because initially, with every uncomfortable emotion, the initial response and the normal response for most human beings, except for a few exceptional saints that exist somewhere in the world, the normal response is, this is too overwhelming. And it's anxiety-inducing. And it translates and results in the question, lama, why is this happening to me? But as she writes so beautifully in this article, that she went through this a number of times, she had to work and process and to really put in a lot of effort to turn the lama into the lama. Why? Not why is this happening to me, but for what? Because at the end of the day, as we know, why something happens to us is a question that none of us could ever answer. Because we don't know. That's the bottom line. However, and we don't know, it's not in our control. God's plan is God's plan. We have no idea whether it's a personal challenge or a collective challenge. We don't know the answer to that. I've said with you many times, I've been asked that question many times. As an answer, it's a question I cannot answer because I don't know, nor you don't know, no one knows. But an answer that we could answer, normally it's only an answer that we can answer ourselves, is not the lama question, but lama. What for what? What am I going to do with this? How am I going to become a better person through this? What am I going to build through this? And in the article where I read this recently, this particular woman did some amazing things. She started a support group. She started connecting with others. She started doing amazing things, creating awareness for all sorts of mental health issues. And she did amazing things. Does she wish she wouldn't have the challenge? Of course. But it's there. So now it depends. It's there and it's on the surface a negative thing. But then, what? Not why, but what? That shift to the why, from the why to the what, is very difficult, but it's very powerful. I said before about nisayon, right? We ask God not to test us. So it's interesting that when we talk about tests that God gives us sometimes, in small ways or big ways, God gives tests to people many very often. And it's, the word for test is nisayon, but in Hebrew, you know, many Hebrew words mean many different things. That's the beauty of Hebrew. Very often, that it can mean one word can mean different things, and they're connected. They're intrinsically connected. We have a principle in the Jewish language, in the Hebrew language, the Holy Tongue, or the classical Hebrew language, that when words mean more than one thing, it's because those two things are actually connected, spiritually connected. Otherwise, it wouldn't be. There's no random in Hebrew. Everything's mechuvan. Everything's exact. So the word nisayon can be a test, and that's what it means, which means a challenge, something on the surface which is negative and difficult and overwhelming. And yet the word nisayon could also mean a banner, to lift up. There's a verse in Tehillim in Psalms where King David says, Arim nisiya, lift up my banner. It's like a sign of victory, a sign of winning, a sign of strength, a sign of determination, right? Upliftingness. And why are those two things connected? Because what lifts us up is a challenge. We don't want challenges, but the truth is that if we take a challenge properly and we say, what can it do for me? And we give up the lama and we engage in the lama, what, not the why, it can actually lift us up and make us much stronger and much better and much more uplifted people. And that's the perspective, I guess, not only about anxiety, but it's about everything that comes our way in life. Just on that, just this past Shabbat, it was just a beautiful moment. I had Dean and I and Rabbi Levy and his wife, we hosted a Shabbat Barakah to my house. We had like 40 young people. It was a beautiful, beautiful event. And I went around the table, and because there were a lot of people, I didn't ask everyone to say Dvar Torah because we'd be there to Sunday morning. But so I gave everyone like a very quick limit, and I said a very, very quick blessing to the bride and groom. And if you want, you can quickly connect it to the parsha, if you can think of something, or any parsha around this time of the year. So not everyone could think of the parasha, but everyone gave a blessing. It was very beautiful. And then one young girl just said something so amazing. And I walked over to it afterwards and I said, I hope you don't mind, but I'm going to use it this coming Thursday morning. She said, oh, man. And you know, in the last week's parasha, we actually read about the man that would fall from heaven. Right? And, I mean, the story, of course, is that the Jews came out of Egypt and they took out, you know, unleavened bread, matzah, and they had what to eat for a few weeks. But afterwards, everything ran out, right? And they were left in the wilderness without anything to eat. And of course, they got anxious. And then God said he's going to give them the water coming from the Be'er Shel Miriam, the well of Miriam. And then he would also give them the manna, which was some sort of seeds that fell from heaven every day. And there was enough for each member of each family. And the great miracle of the manna, as we know, was that it would taste like whatever you want. So you just, right? There were certain things that didn't have, but it would taste like whatever you want. Except for a couple of things. There's a whole reason behind that. In fact, I'll just show it to you. It's an interesting thing. You know, it's an interesting thing that, I don't know if you ever, you know, on Shabbat, there's different foods people eat. And one of the traditional foods, I'm not sure anyone here is familiar with it, it's called Eyeh Mitzibel, which is egg and onion salad. Huh? Yeah, read to you, yeah. Egg and onion, right? Why does it come? It comes from the idea, because there's the idea to eat onion on Shabbat. Why? Because on Shabbat, it's interesting that on Shabbat we say the blessing of the man comes from Shabbat. Although the man itself did not fall on Shabbat, right? God gave a double portion on Friday, which is why we have two chalot at the Shabbos table, remembering the double portion of man. That's why we cover the chalot, one of the reasons, because the man fell, there was a layer of dew underneath the man and a layer of dew on top of the man. So we have the tablecloth and the cover over the chalas, so it's like the man. But we do a lot of things in Shabbat to do with the man. So the manna that fell from heaven. One of the things it didn't have was the taste of onion. Because apparently it was harmful, that taste was harmful to pregnant women. I'm not sure what the biology behind that is, but that's what it said. Pregnant women. So in order sort of to make up that taste on Shabbat, we eat onion, so to speak, to remember that it wasn't part of the man. Anyway, okay. But the man could taste, basically the man could taste whatever you wanted. So this young girl, she's asked her to say something. She says, we learn about you know, the falling of the manna and came from heaven. She had learned that in some shir. It tastes like everything. And she says, her blessing for the bride and groom is, you know, life comes with all sorts of things. And all, you know, some very, very good experiences, but let's be real, sometimes life comes with things that aren't so good. So whatever happens to you, you should know, is like the man, she says. It's going to taste exactly what you want it to taste like. And I thought that was so brilliant. I've never seen that in any book or anything. I think it was just her idea. And I thought it was unbelievably brilliant. And that's exactly what it is. We get things, it's a beautiful perspective if you can build that perspective. We don't always do that, certainly initially, right? But if we can take things of life and we can say to ourselves, you know, this is like the man. It's going to taste the way I want it to taste. That's amazing. So I thought I would share that with you, and it's very very much in line with the foundation of this book. So back to anxiety. This is the concept of anxiety. Anxiety, if you say the word anxiety, no one thinks of it as a good thing. Because initially it's not a good thing. It's an uncomfortable thing. It's almost like a toxic emotion. And it can be very debilitating and paralyzing. Right? And we don't get things done. And if we're very, very scared of anxiety, as he said, we're scared of having it, then we get even more scared. And we just delve more and spiral greater and deeper into a circle of anxiety. And it paralyzes us, right? But if we decide that, no, if it's here with us, we need to understand it. And we need to know what we can do with it. And instead of getting overwhelming and saying, why is this happening to me? We say, what am I going to do about it? And am I going to use it to propel me into a much, much greater way of living? Then that's like the man. We give it a good taste and it works for us. Hence the title of the book, Thriving with Anxiety. And throughout the book, which you're not going to do today, he goes through 9 chapters, about 9 perspectives, 9 strategies of things that you can actually do with anxiety. But just for now, let's go back to the introduction. So he says, he raises an interesting thing about anxiety, right? And that is that before COVID, one in 3 Americans, adults, experience an anxiety disorder at some point in their life. Which is not great news, right? Almost 1 in 5 at any point in time. Among teens, it was even worse. Teens, interestingly, suffer more from anxiety sometimes, right? So you can imagine, needless to say, all these figures went up after COVID, right? You know that anxiety increased after COVID? And I've never seen this, but he says, interestingly, the first half of the 20th century has been called the age of anxiety. Right? So he pauses and he says, let's ask a question. Why is our society more anxious today than ever? It should be the other way around, correct? It should be we live in times where we have what we need, basically. Most people have more than they need. We have technology, we have luxury, we have plenty. It's a generation of plenty. And yet we're much more anxious, right? Now, there are many reasons that one gives. He doesn't give them all, but there are many reasons, and I think part of it has to do, and it's connected with what we're going to say in a minute, that there's also a very big decrease in meaning and purpose, and that is not good for anxiety and so on. But part of that is, and this is an amazing thing, I mean, if you talk to people from the previous generations, I don't think anyone will tell you that their life wasn't tough, right? People that came from Europe. They all lived very tough lives. I remember my grandfather, Alav HaShalom, who was an amazing man, and I was very close to him and learned a lot from him. And I never appreciated the stories he would tell me until later on in life, when you know we have to live real life and you start thinking about it. They were poverty stricken. His mother died when he was young from starvation. At 13, 14, he got himself a job. Did I ever tell you this? He got himself a job. He was an excellent, my grandfather was an excellent Baal Koreh. He read the Torah on Shabbat, right? After a while, he stopped preparing because he knew it by heart. In fact, I remember one Shabbat, for some reason, I think one of us went well or something. Maybe he was there and he couldn't go to shul. So we actually bought a Torah scroll and we made a minyan in our own home. I remember an observatory. And my father read the Torah. My father was good, but he wasn't like my grandfather in the reading of the Torah. And at that point, my grandfather had stopped laying because he couldn't see very well. And the law is that you can't do it by heart. You have to read the text. And he was sitting there without a chumash and without the text, without the notes. You know, and the Torah, it's all without vowels, without notes. You have to remember it. And my father was laying and my grandfather was correcting him. How did he become so good? Because when he was 15, listen to this. When he was 15, he was hungry. And he got himself a job to read the Torah. And the shul where he read the Torah, the rabbi said to him, I'll only let you read if you come every Shabbat morning and I'm going to test you. It's got to be perfect before the davening starts. And if it's good, I'll give you a glass of milk and a bun, like a Danish.
What country was it?
It was a little shtetl called Dokshitsi, which depending on which year it was either White Russia or Poland. Right? And he used to go every week for that. That's what he did. That's what motivated him. Because for him to have a glass, I mean, you offer a kid a glass of milk and a Danish today for something to be a little bit uncomfortable. I don't think you get very far. But that's what he used to do. Right. So they had tough lives. Today we have a problem, right? which is why anxiety is on the rise, and it's also why anxiety is so debilitating today. Because today we have a comfortable life and we are petrified of being uncomfortable. That's the society we live in today. We are scared to become uncomfortable. And as soon as we are uncomfortable, it's like, what's happening to me? As soon as something happens, as soon as I feel not right, what's happening to me? And because I can't bear to feel that way, I'm scared of it, so it gets worse. And we end up doing what? We end up running. Now, we need to make that very clear. There are different forms of anxiety and different levels of anxiety, and medication is an option and should be an option for some people, and it's important. Right? I'm not, obviously this book is in favor not of medication. He thinks he can take care of it without medication. That's fine. It doesn't always work for everyone. Like I said before, not everything works for everyone. And professional intervention and medication intervention is sometimes the right thing to do. But nevertheless, it's definitely overprescribed today. Without a question. Why? Because we're so scared of having it that we go into a frenzy, and then we fear for having it, and then we have more of it, and then we end up running to something to calm it down. Right? And he gives a beautiful analogy. He says, when anxiety hits us, what we need to realize is it's not a bad thing. So he gives a beautiful analogy. He says, however, he says like this. At a basic level, anxiety is a little like a smoke alarm. Right? If the alarm goes off because you left the burner under a skillet after you finish cooking, it's not a bad thing, it's a good thing. The alarm alerts us that we have a problem to deal with, as long as we heed the sound of that alarm early enough and take appropriate action. In this example, turn off the burner. We can be perfectly fine. However, if we jump up and down and start cursing at ourselves for letting the alarm go off, or we overreact to the alarm, or we're making a bad situation out of a potential positive. Worse yet, if we disconnect the alarm because the constant blaring is disturbing and upsetting, well, you're going to burn down a house. Right? It's very simple. In other words, it's a beautiful analogy. If the smoke alarm goes off, and your main focus is to get it to stop beeping, the house is going to burn down. Now, everyone who's heard a smoke alarm knows that it's very annoying. But it's a wake-up call, and it's a good thing, because it's alerting you to go and take care of a potentially disastrous situation. And if you take care early enough, it's a good thing, right? Now, it's an amazing thing, because the more used to being comfortable we are, the more anxiety we're going to have. Because even today, it's a research fact that in countries which people are doing it tough, there's actually less anxiety. It's a funny thing. In the countries in Africa, there's less anxiety there. Now, they should have much more than they have, and they should have a much better life, and we should help with that, and society should help with that. That's true. But nevertheless, the fact is that there's less anxiety. Because we're so obsessed today with safety and security. People are like, in all levels, like, it's an amazing thing. I've always wondered, like, I've heard a story lately about parents who send their little kids to kindergarten today. So there's a new thing, there's a new, what I call a complete mishigas. They don't let the teachers teach anymore. They're busy half the day with paperwork because they've got to send pictures to the parents and report cards to the parents. Like, seriously, when my kid was 3 years old, I really couldn't care, like, how he's progressing in his academic amazing studies, and I certainly wasn't thinking about which university or even which yeshiva they're going to make it into, depending on how they're doing in the kindergarten years, right? For me, it was a glorified, beautiful, and a very professional babysitting service where they teach them really good and fundamental things, and each child's going to pick it up when they need to, and it's all fine. And they do, right? And there was no, well, when my kids went to kindergarten, most of them anyways, there was no WhatsApps and no pictures and no report cards. And it was great, because you know what the teachers did all day? They were nurturing, they were lovely, they took care of the kids and had a great time. And they didn't have to fill out endless amount of paperwork, and it was, why? Because everyone's so scared today. Like, just relax, get on with life. And, you know, I once saw a parenting book, and it was such a beautiful thing. It was a parenting book, it was called The Blessing of a Skinned Knee, exactly, right? Blessing of a Skinned Knee. Of a Skinned Knee, right? I don't know, but it was a really good book. But it was based on this idea also that, like, parenting comes, you've got to let your kids fail. And if they go out with a bicycle and they get knocked into a tree and they come back with a skinned knee, it's fine. Nothing is going to happen. Right? But we have this obsession with being comfortable, with being perfect. There's another problem that he doesn't talk about in the book, but I want to add this in. That the more comfortable we get and the more comfortable we are in our life, the more we think we're in control. And that's disaster. Why? From a Jewish point of view, that is mamash terrible. Because the more we think we're in control, the more upset and anxious we get when things don't go our way. Which is the whole concept in Judaism, one of the most fundamental concepts, and one of the most fundamental concepts related to the concept of anxiety, is emunah bitachon. Rabbeinu Bahai, who lived in the 12th, 13th century, who wrote a very, very classic text called Shara Bitachon, the gateway to trust in Hashem, right? Predicates the whole idea of bitachon, of trusting in Hashem. It's a very complicated topic, and it's going to come in. If you're going to have a series on anxiety, it's going to come in. We'll talk about it a little bit today and a little bit in the coming weeks, for sure. But the idea of bitachon is to be calm. Why? To be calm. Why? Not because things are wonderful. Because I've let go. I've given up control. The most calming, inducing things that can happen to a person is to give up control. To understand we're not in control, and to understand that we're in God's hands. He runs the show. Now, I don't always like the way He runs the show. I mean, I'm not, who am I to like, not to like, but I'm saying as human beings, we often don't like the way He's running the show. We often don't understand how He runs the show. But the concept to understand that He is holding our hand and He is running the show is amazing. But to understand that and to appreciate that and to internalize that means we have to give up control. And when you live in a life where everything is going well for some people, or a society in general, it's affluent and it's going well and we have what to eat and things are going, it is very hard to give up control. And when we think we're in control, because why? Because if we're successful, we fall into the trap, as the Torah warns us, by the way. It's an explicit verse in Deuteronomy, in Dvarim, where the Torah warns us that the more successful you get, the more you're going to think, very famous expression, you're going to think, Kochi ve'otzim yadi asa li et ha'chayil hazeh, that my own strength and my own aptitude, my own brilliance, brought my success. Right? Now that's a very difficult topic, and we'll come back to it, but just very briefly, one of the foundations of Judaism is to understand that nothing is because of our own greatness. Nothing. Right? Because if God doesn't want us to have something, we won't have it no matter how brilliant we are. But He did set up a system, and this is a complicated system to understand, that although everything comes from Him, He wanted us to create the channel. So if you go to bed every day and you sleep, you won't make any money. That's true. Why? Not because when you go out there and you do a good deal, your brilliance made the money. It really didn't make the money. The money comes straight from God. Right? It's a very interesting philosophy. This is everything in life. I'm just giving parnasa, I'm giving livelihood as an example. This is a deep philosophical thing. It takes a lot of effort to come to terms with it and to internalize it. To understand that the God wants us to create that channel for His blessing to flow through. Right? But if we don't create that channel, He won't give it to us, because that's the way He designed the world. Another discussion why that is, but that's the way He designed the world, that we need to create what's called in Hasidic philosophy a keli, a vessel for His blessing. But the blessing is His. Only the channel we create, He allows us to create. Right? And therefore, if He doesn't want to give us something, no matter how brilliant we are, it's not going to happen. And if He does want to give us something, no matter how stupid our keli was, He'll also give it to us. Now, obviously, we've got to try our best. That's what we do in the natural world. Right? We've got to create that natural sort of channel. That's why a very fascinating thing, I mentioned the manna falling from heaven before, right? So you know that when we wash for bread, there's a mitzvah that we have to bench, right? After we eat a meal that's got bread, we bench. And bench has a number of blessings. It's got four blessings, essentially. And they were made throughout history by different people. The first blessing of benching, was made by Moshe Rabbeinu, by Moses, to thank God for the manna that fell from heaven. And when we eat a meal of bread, we're still saying that same blessing. Why are we doing that? We don't get manna from heaven. It was 40 years in history, in Jewish history, where people didn't have to work for bread. They got up and the manna fell from heaven. Right? And by the way, you think that was easy? We are taught in the Talmud that wasn't easy either. You know why? Because people find it very difficult to give up control. And what happened with the manna was, I'll come back to the benching in a minute, What happened with the manna was that God, that was also a test in its own right, especially in the beginning. People got up in the morning and what fell? Exactly what you need for that day. So each night when you went to sleep, there was nothing there. Right? And we are taught that was very difficult. That was a test. I'm assuming that the test got easier as the years gone by. You know, when you're doing it for 10 years, 15 years, and it's happening every day. So you trust it's going to happen tomorrow. But in the very beginning, imagine getting manna from heaven. It's a beautiful miracle. And then going to sleep and there's nothing in the house. What am I going to do tomorrow? You got to trust that it's going to come from heaven again, right? So anyway, so back to the manna. So we're still making that blessing. Why? To teach us that the bread that we eat is also manna from heaven. It's no different. No different whatsoever. Because it's not we're not in control. We're not in control at all. And unfortunately, we get reminders every so often. Sometimes not such nice reminders that we're not in control. That's why COVID, for example, was so anxiety-inducing, because our plans were just thrown in disarray. Because we're not in control. Right? So that concept of being in control, and the more successful we are, the more in control we kind of want to become, and we talk ourselves into it, that all our successes and all our plans work because we do them. Now, that's not to say we shouldn't plan, by the way. We have to live a responsible life. That's a moral thing to do. And we have to create the channel for through which God will send us all the blessings that we need. But we shouldn't fool ourselves that we're in control of receiving those blessings. The more successful we are, the more prone we are to be in control. That's what the Torah warns us. And the more successful we're going to start thinking that it's us. And then when things don't go, when things aren't perfect and things are uncomfortable, we get extremely anxious, right? Now, as he points out in that book as well, he says he's not saying that to live a life of consistency and calmness is a bad thing. Of course we do. To a degree, we all seek happiness, we seek comfort, we seek calmness. That's what we're supposed to do. But to expect certainty, right? To expect certainty is a very terrible thing. And that's part of which, and I think it's a very good theory, I think that's part of which why there's such a rise in anxiety today, because we are so scared of the discomfort of even initial or a little bit of anxiety, that all it does is it leads to more anxiety. And we don't use it out. We don't treat it as the alarm bell. We don't treat it as a wake-up call. We don't treat it as a reminder to do things different. Now, the different things that we can do, he's going to go through, and we'll go through some of those in the coming weeks. But he says, anxiety can do so many constructive things when we stop running away from it, right? Anxiety can enhance self-awareness of both our strengths and areas for growth. So just to finish up, I want to just, again, go back to the idea of bitachon, and I want to just explain something. And again, we'll go through more in the coming weeks, but the emunah bitachon combination is very complex. And essentially, it boils down to something that I just learned recently. I was learning a talk of the Lubavitcher Rebbe last week. And he makes the point, which I've seen in his talks many, very, very often. He says that, and I've mentioned this, I think, last term a little bit. He says that we have to understand that a Jew, particularly, because we have a soul that's so divine and so infinite, that we have that capacity. He's talking about emunah and bitachon, that we have that capacity to carry two opposite things at the same time. Because bitachon means, for the future, it means I'm in God's hands, and I trust it's going to be okay. He's leading me, it's going to be all fine. Now, the problem is how that works with right now, it's not fine. Right? And in that classic essay of Bitachon from Rabbeinu Bachai, he talks about this. He says, because you see, there's the belief that we have, foundational to Jewish belief, is that everything that God does ultimately for the good, which means if God does something for me, it's for the good, it's for my good, right? So then how does that work? If something happens to me that's challenging today, so I have to believe, no, it's for the good. So I'm going to give up. I'm going to let go of control. God, whatever you want to do, I know it's for the good. I don't understand you, but it's for the good. So I'm okay with it, and I'm just going to make it work, right? And yet we are taught you have to have bitachon that tomorrow it's going to be okay. Why should I have bitachon tomorrow is going to be okay? If everything that God does is for the good, so whatever he wants to do tomorrow, good, bad, I don't know, it's all for the good, right? But it doesn't work like that. This is the complexity of emunah bitachon. I'm just mentioning it. I mean, we can't cover this topic in 7 minutes, but right? But we can. We actually can carry two opposites. And the reason is like this. I mean, not the reason. What it looks like is like this. God wants us, he gave us a mitzvah to pray. In our prayers, we are supposed to ask for good things. We're supposed to ask for health. We're supposed to ask for wealth. We're supposed to ask for all the blessings that God gives us, right? That's our job. And we have to believe that God listens to our prayers. And therefore, we have to believe that God is going to answer us. And if someone is unwell, that tomorrow they'll be fine. But at the same time, we have to be able to carry that opposite feeling with us that right now, it's not fine. But that not fine right now is ultimately for my good. And that right now, that... So I have to believe that tomorrow it's going to sort itself out. But what it is now, I have to take the lama and make it lama. It doesn't mean I'm okay with staying this for the next 10 years. I'm not. Because I know that's going to be okay. I'm going to keep davening and it's going to turn out okay. And I have to have that full faith and full calmness that it's going to be okay. I'm not saying we can all reach that. I'm just saying that's the ultimate, right? But for right now, it's ultimately for the good. And I have to take what I'm given now and give it the right taste. And turn it from the lama into the lama, what I have now. Because that's where emunah comes in. Because I have to believe that if God gave it to me today, it's for my good. But I know tomorrow it's going to be fine. It's very opposite then. Because it goes, why does it have to be tomorrow fine if now it's good? You understand? Why does it have to change tomorrow if I believe that now it's really good for me? But that's the two opposites that we can do. Because God wants us to believe that it's going to be okay. And that belief itself will bring the blessing. And that's for tomorrow. But for now, if he, for whatever reason, chose to give me a challenge, that challenge is ultimately for the good. And I have to change it from the lama into the lama. Now, I'm saying that also because, you know, when I read a book, and I mean, you know this from me from many, many, many times already, but so my vision and my perspective is I'm looking at it through the lens of Jewishness, right? I'm always seeing like what I'm, even if what I read sounds good, but I always have to test it. Is it what I believe? It might sound good, but is it what I believe, right? So I just want to make sure kind of thing, and all this is in line with Jewish thinking. And if it's not, I would always tell you, as I always do. So... when you, but over here it is in line, but you might think it's not, because when you read the literature on anxiety, it always sounds like anxiety is a very bad thing. Why? Because mostly anxiety, especially accelerated anxiety, is about worrying about something that I can't control. It's worrying about what's going to happen next week, the week after, the 10 years from now, right? That's what anxiety is. But that's not how anxiety starts. Now, the anxiety, when we talk about using anxiety for the good, it's about the anxiety that I have now. In other words, it's the beginning of anxiety. That I'm starting to feel uncomfortable, I'm starting to feel anxious. What you have now, you don't have to get rid of it, you can use it. You can live with it and propel it and channel it into something positive, as we'll talk about more in the next coming weeks. But when you start not using it for the good, and it ends up being worrying about things that you have absolutely no control over, that's when it starts to interfere with your bitachon. So the two things are 100%. In other words, what's happening today to me, we have to apply emunah. It is not good. It is uncomfortable. But I believe that God is with me. He's holding my hand. Ultimately, it's for my good. What's my mission? What am I going to do with it today? How am I going to change the lama into the lama? But I'm also, because I'm normal, I'm also letting my anxiety get the better of me, and I'm starting to worry about next week and the month ahead and 10 months ahead and so on and so forth. That needs to be gotten rid of, because there I have to have bitachon. Bitachon means I have to really believe it's going to turn out okay. And the two things can happen at the same time. I'm saying that particularly also because that's true. So what I'm experiencing today has to ignite a sense of urgency to do something today. What I'm worried about next month, I should have to let go and have full bitachon. I'm saying that because that's true individually, and it's also true collectively. Because Am Yisrael, the Jewish people, are still going through a collective challenge, right? And we still hear bad news, and we still wake up and terrible things happen. The biggest one, of course, last week with the 21 soldiers, but even today, right? And it's still very, very worrying. And we have to kind of, just while I'm on this topic, we have to kind of work with this. We have to work with ourselves to carry those two opposites. What's happening today is bad. We have to employ emunah. Ultimately, we don't understand God's plan. So what does the feeling have to do today? It has to just create a sense of urgency. So what are we doing more? How are we fighting it more? Whatever that means, or whatever that what is going to mean for each individual, and for each place, and for each community, and so on. But in terms of letting us then spiral into that, because some people are doing this, and it's normal, and I understand that. Because now people are starting to talk what's going to be, and it doesn't look good for the future. And, you know, people are sort of starting to paint a very bleak future picture. That's something we have to fight. And that's not a contradiction to saying that what happened today is bad. And although what happened today is bad, and it's terrible, but we have to accept it and know it's ultimately for the good. But at the same time, we have to really work on our bitachon to know that it's going to be amazing. What's going to come out of this is going to be absolutely amazing. It might not look like it at the moment, or often doesn't look like it, but it is going to be. That's our fundamental belief. And we learn from the past, it always has been. We've always emerged, and we will emerge. We'll emerge stronger and greater and more Jewish and more resilient and more spiritual, more everything. It's going to be amazing. What we do now we have to fight the evil, because the evil is happening for reasons that we don't know. So those two things can come together. So just before we finish, talking about anxiety, I'm just joking. Here's your chance to reduce my anxiety. So in 2 weeks, I told this. No, I'm working on the anxiety, don't worry. I'm channeling it to a sense of urgency. So 2 weeks from tonight is the Bina 25 celebration. We've been here for 25 years. And it's, you all been getting the things. So please do me a favor. If you haven't booked, help my, I'm channeling my anxiety into a sense of urgency, and I'm going to drive you everyone crazy. If anyone talks to me after 2 weeks from now, it'll be a miracle. So I ask you in advance, apologies. But if you haven't booked, book now. And also spread the word, and please ask everyone else to book. We want to have it to be a beautiful night. And in times like this, this is even more important. We have to spread more light and more positivity. So we'll see you next week, but also see you on the 15th.